Esther chapter 3. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. He thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they had shown him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day, and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered abroad, and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. And their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws, neither it is not for the king's prophet to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business, to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. And the king said unto Haman, The silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces, to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day morning, we come again to the look at the book of Esther. Two Lord's Days ago, we looked at chapter 1, and we noted the king Ahasuerus, or the king Xerxes, that he had a great rule. He ruled over 127 provinces, and yet he could not rule over himself. In chapter 1, we have this incident of King Ahasuerus' life, and it takes place, we read in verse 3, in the third year of his reign. Now, last Lord's Day, we looked at chapter 2, and another incident in the life of King Ahasuerus and of Mordecai and of Esther. We read in verse 16 that event took place in the seventh year of his reign. And we see how he went about to find another queen and how God in his providence brought Esther to that position. Now this Lord's Day morning we come and we look at another incident in this kingdom. We look at an incident that takes place, we read in verse 7, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. Here we learn about the promotion of Haman in verses 1 through 6, and then the plot of Haman in verses 7 through 15. The promotion of Haman and the plot of Haman. Let's look first this morning at the promotion of Haman. Let us see first that Haman is set up and then he blows up. He's set up in verse 1 and then he blows up in verses 5 and 6. And then let us look at Mordecai and his unwillingness to bend down to Mordecai, or to Haman, excuse me, in verses 2 through 4. Let us see first Haman being set up and then blowing up, and then let us look at Mordecai's unwillingness to bend down. Let's look first at Haman's promotion, then his pedigree, and then his pride. Let's consider Haman, his promotion, his pedigree, and his pride. We see in verse 1 that after these things, after the two incidents that have occurred in chapters 1 and 2, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. He promotes him, and that word in Hebrew means to enlarge him. In other words, he expanded his responsibilities. It says he advanced him, and that word in Hebrew means he lifted him up. And that's described in that second part of chapter 1. He was no longer an equal. He was set above the other princes. He was not one of those seven princes, but now he is, in many senses, the prime minister. He's second in command behind the king. But as we read of Haman's advancement, we must consider the words of Solomon, words that we read not that long ago when we read through the book of Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 5 through 7, we read these words. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low places. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Solomon says in his experience, in his observations of life, often things are topsy-turvy. Those that are rich, those that are worthy, rich of character, are not always those that are advanced and lifted up in the kingdoms and corporations of this world. Sometimes God is pleased to raise up a man like Daniel or Nehemiah and place him among kings. But Solomon says in his experience, often it's just the opposite. There are those that deserve to be on horses, they're on their feet. There are those that deserve to be on their feet, and they're on the horse. And do we not see the same here with this man, Haman? A man who we will see was proud. A man who was seeking to advance himself for his own glory. And so, naive Ahasuerus, gullible Ahasuerus, raises him up to this place of honor and this place of responsibility. We've seen his promotion. Let's consider here as well his pedigree. It says of this man, Haman, that he was an Agagite. In other words, he was a descendant of King Agag. Agag was the king of the people of Amalek. Agag was not the name of just one king, it was the name of whoever reigned as the king of Amalek. It was a title, really, that was given to the king of Amalek. The false prophet Balaam speaks of Agag in Numbers 24:7. He says that the king of the people of God, of Jacob, will be higher than the king of Amalek or of Agag. Remember also in 1 Samuel 15 that Saul, the king, failed to kill Agag and all the Amalekites that God had called him to put to death. God had called him to do so to demonstrate his wrath against those that served him not and obeyed not the gospel. And he chose to do it through Saul and his armies, and Saul failed to do so. In that incident in 1 Samuel 15, Samuel eventually takes up the sword and kills Agag. But it's pretty clear from this passage that all the women and children that were spared, particularly those sons of Agag, there must have been some that were spared, and so that reign continues amongst the Amalekites, even up to this portion of Scripture. So we learn that he was an Agagite. But we also learn, right, that Agag comes from the tribe or the people of Amalek. We learn in Genesis 36, verses 4 and 12, that Amalek was a grandson of Esau. Remember the words of God through Paul in Romans 9:13? Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. You see, we have a description of those that are enemies of the people of God. King Ahasuerus didn't take a Mede or a Persian and raise him up to be his prime minister. He took an Amalekite. Not a pure Persian or a pure Mede. But he raised up this enemy of God into this high place. The whole book of one chapter of the book of Obadiah, that prophecy of God through Obadiah, is a prophecy against Edom, who is Esau. It's against his mountain, it's against his domain, it's against where he lives, but it's against him. Because God will judge Esau and bring them to naught. So we have to recognize that Haman was not only a proud man, but he was also an enemy of God. And he came from a line of enemies or oppressors of God's people. We see his promotion, and I think we also see in verses 5 and 6, the outflow of his pride. This man had just become second in command. Everyone but one is bowing down to him in worship. In worship. Because the king has commanded it, and they're doing it, and there's just one man that won't. And he is irritated. Not slightly irritated, he is very wroth. He's full of wrath, it says in verse 5. Pride leads to wrath, and wrath and anger lead to murder. And we see it in the heart of Haman. He's not happy with everybody but one not worshiping him. He wants everyone. You have to wonder if he didn't even want Ahasuerus to bow down to him. Was Ahasuerus so gullible as to think this man, full of pride, would not eventually try to secede him and take the kingdom from him? Is that not what so many self-serving people are seeking to do in our nation, in the nations of the world, and in corporations in our nation? Are not so many of them promoting themselves to glorify themselves? Not to serve the public, to serve the consumer, as well as the stockholder, and as well the employees, but they're serving themselves. And how many gullible leaders will fall for those that are seeking to advance themselves for their own glory. Haman was seeking to advance himself for his own glory. He was dedicated to it, apparently in a way that the other princes weren't. And he gets his reward, doesn't he? He's elevated to that position. He's worked hard. He's manipulated. He's always been trying to get the next level. And apparently he's worked harder than the others. So we see his wrath and his murder, which must have at the heart been pride. But we also learn from the Proverbs that pride comes before a fall. Sometimes it doesn't come until the judgment day when that fall is recognized. But oftentimes it comes in this life. When we're filled with pride, God will bring us down. Believer and unbeliever. He will bring us low. So we see Haman set up, and then we see him blowing up in verses 1 and then 5 and 6. But let us now look at Mordecai and his unwillingness to bend down. This event that stirred up the wrath and pride of Haman. What I think we have to understand here is that clearly Haman was asked to do more than just show honor to whom honor is due. He was required to show religious worship to Haman. He was required to put Haman in the place of God. In the Westminster Annotations, a commentary on the Scriptures, we read this of this passage. It says, he refused to do because the kind of worship that was required was unlawful, being only due to God. You see, this had been attempted before. If you remember, King Nebuchadnezzar, a little more than 100 years ago, the king of the Babylonian Empire, which Cyrus had taken over, years before. He had tried this with Daniel in Daniel chapter 3. Had he not? And with those men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those Babylonian names representing three Jewish young men as well. You see, Haman would show honor to whom honor was due, but he would not bow down to Ahasuerus or Haman, as though they were God. He would not stoop to that level. And I think as we consider this, we must recognize the words of Deuteronomy chapter 25. Please turn with me there. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 19. Remember, these words of Deuteronomy are from the mouth of Moses. He speaks them to the people of God just before they go into the promised land. It's Moses' last sermon. It's a reiteration of all that God has taught the people of God and what they ought to have upon their minds as they go into the promised land. And this is what God says through his prophet Moses. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when ye were come forth out of Egypt. How he met thee by the way and smote the hindermost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. You see, Amalek didn't take on their forces. Amalek went after the weak, the sick, the elderly, the young. They came and swooped down on the backside of the people of God, showing no mercy to those that were lagging behind. So God goes on to say, therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. God had told the people of God that once they were settled, to blot out, to destroy all of Amalek. They failed to do it. And so God calls them to do it through King Saul in 1 Samuel 15. And they fail again to do it. And so the people of Amalek continue to be a thorn in the side of the people of God. God continues to use them as a chastening rod upon His people for their failure to blot them out as He had commanded. They had forgotten to do it, but I think it's clear that Mordecai had not forgotten. Mordecai was well aware of who Haman was, what his pedigree was, and that he was still an enemy of God. You see, also, Haman was not only asked to do this once, but then it's clear that those that were servants of the king, those that were in his court and working with him, they began to ask him, why won't you do this? Why won't you bow down? They keep hounding him. They keep pressurizing him. I think we all have experienced that, haven't we? Standing up for the Lord and then being hounded over and over again, over and over. Well, give in, give in, give in this time. And how often we do give in eventually. We give in to the pressure that's applied to us by the heathen. Here, his comrades in his workplace are telling him to give it up. Give it up. But I think clearly they also are asking him for the reason for the hope that is within him. Because he, in his explanation, we learn here, tells them that he is a Jew. He's not told them up to this point. But now he must disclose what motivates him, what's at the core of his life, why he will not do this thing that everybody else will. Apparently, even other Jews in Shushan. What Mordecai will not, and he explains why he won't. Because he's one of God's. He's one of Jacob. He's of Israel. Haman's an enemy of God's people. And he of the king expect me to bow down to him and worship him as only I worship my God. I worship him and him only. You see, we live in a day and age where it's not necessarily a monarch or one person in our nation that we're asked to bow down to, but it is the civil government itself. That's an idol in our nation. How many people think that the civil government will provide them their daily bread? And will provide them health care and everything else? How many look to the government for those things that we are told to look only to God for? He would not bow himself down to the idol of that culture. And so we as God's people must not bow ourselves down to the idols of our culture. They come in a little bit different shape, but they're the same at the core, aren't they? Worshipping someone, something other than God. We see the promotion of Haman in verses 1 through 6, and then in verses 7 through 15, we see the plot of Haman. The promotion of Haman, the plot of Haman. We learn that this took place in the month Nisan, which is the first month, and that's the month of March and April. And then we learn later that this plot is going to be carried out in the month Adar, which is not a Jewish name, but is the Persian name for the 12th month, which is February, March. So take that into account. The month Nisan is a Jewish term, and the month Adar is a Persian term. Let us look first at Haman's plot in verses 7 through 11, and then Ahasuerus' command in verses 12 through 15. We see first in verse 7 that Haman was an idolater. He was a superstitious man. He planned to kill God's people as he went to the lots. He went to Pur, which is Persian for lots. He was one that observed times. He was looking for his own false gods to tell him what would be the perfect day for him to accomplish his desire. And yet the God of all the universe causes the lot to be cast. And the lot that is cast ends up being the 13th day of, or excuse me, the 12th, yeah, 13th day of the 12th month. In other words, the lot is cast, and now Haman is going to have to wait 11 months. The lot wasn't cast by years, it was just cast by months and days. And so 11 months must now pass until Haman has his desire fulfilled. He's looking for an answer from his false god, a god that is not, and the God of heaven and earth spreads it out for 11 months, delays it for 11 months. And then God begins to work his plan. We see also in verse 8 that Haman is not only an idolater and a superstitious man, we see that he is a liar, just as his father Satan was a liar from the beginning and an accuser of the brethren. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Well, that's true. They have their own religious laws. But neither keep they the king's laws. That's a lie. Neither is it for the king's profit to suffer them. The Jewish people were predominantly seeking to serve the Lord. They were useful in those kingdoms. Mordecai himself and Esther were useful in the very court of the king. And so if you notice, Haman doesn't even tell him the name of these people. He describes them and he lies about them. He says they don't keep the king's laws, and yet in Jeremiah 29:7, the prophet Jeremiah told them, into whatever city, whatever place you go, keep the laws of the king. Honor the civil magistrate in that sphere. And so he lies about them. But then in verse 9, we learn that he's a murderer. He wants to kill them. He asks the king to cause it to be written that they may be destroyed. And it says he's willing to pay 10,000 talents of silver. In other words, he's willing to pay the cost, the labor costs of all those that would have to put them to death. He's willing to fork out of his own pocket the monies to pay the people that would kill all the Jews in all the provinces. And this amount of money that's given here in silver would equal over $5 million today. A lot of money. Obviously, Haman had been rewarded in his time as a prince of provinces and been given significant amounts of money. And so he was willing to expend that himself to satisfy his pride and arrogance. For one man. For one man. But we also see that he asks permission in verse 10 and 11. He's not yet taken over the kingship. And so he still asks the king, can he do this? It says in verse 10, the king took off his ring from his hand. He's basically saying, I'm willing for you to make this just as I would make it. The ring would be the signet ring that would seal and certify the actual commandments or decrees that were written. And so the king signs a death warrant for the whole nation. Gullible, naive Ahasuerus falls again into the plots and scheming of those under him. And it says at the end of verse 10, that this man Haman was the Jews' enemy. And that word enemy means oppressor. It literally means to cramp. It comes from a verb to cramp or to oppress. He was an oppressor. His people were oppressors of God, and he himself was an oppressor of the people of God. He was trying to bring to naught God's kingdom, God's people. But then in verses 12 through 15, we have Ahasuerus' command. We have the edict itself in verses 12 through 15a. Then we have the response of the court in 15b. And then we have the city's response in verse 16c. The edict itself is very bloody. All Jews, it says, both young and old in verse 13, little children and women, are to be put to death. All of God's people are to be put to death. It's reminiscent of those words found in Revelation chapter 17, verse 6. There John says, I saw the woman, and that woman that he's speaking of is Babylon, who in verse 5 of that chapter, God says, is the mother of harlots and abominations. Babylon is pictured as the center, as the worst of the world. It is worldliness personified, this woman. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. That's the way God's enemies are. They're drunken with the blood of the saints. It brings them pleasure. They're absorbed in bringing down the kingdom of God. And so this man has been placed as the prime minister of this nation, who is bloodthirsty for the people of God, because they won't worship, because one man of them won't bow the knee to him and treat him as God. He's willing to wipe out the whole nation and bring them to naught. But then we also not only see the edict itself, we see the court's response in verse 16b. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. They sat down to drink. And in the Hebrew idiom here, clearly it means they went to get some alcohol. Either to party, or to salve and soothe their raw consciences. They were either merry and delighting in this, and were going to throw a party between the two of them, and have a few drinks, as they set in order and in place the murder of many, many thousands and thousands of God's people. Or, they were, in fact, sensing some guiltiness over it and sought to alleviate that guilt through the bottle. We see their response. They sat down to drink. But now notice the city's response. But the city Shushan was perplexed. The city Shushan, the inhabitants of that city, were perplexed. The reason it speaks only of Shushan is because that's the capital of the first province. That's where the command first went out and was heard by people. Messengers were on the way with this decree in hand to announce to others in other provinces, but it's been heard first at Shushan. And it says the people are perplexed. Literally, this word means to be disturbed. They're disturbed. They don't understand what is going on. I think what we learn here is that many, just as there are many in our day, there were many in that day in Shushan that had some sense of justice and compassion. Some sense of what's right and what's wrong. And that people ought to be heard. They ought to be found guilty of crimes, of laws that have been set down. So I think we see in here what's often been called common grace. That those that were inhabitants of Shushan, though they were not all believers, clearly of the true God, yet many of them knew right and wrong and knew something was fishy here. But I think it's also likely that they knew the Jewish people to be valuable and not worthy of this punishment. They maybe didn't follow their practices, but they saw them as beneficial to the community. They had a benefit. They profited the whole nation and the city through their enterprise, through their diligent labor. Some of those Jews were providing things for them. They were serving them in some ways. And so I think what we see is that they knew something wasn't right about the justice, but something also was wrong to view these people as not worthy of life. I think they had seen, like many have come to understand, just as Solomon did, again in Ecclesiastes 3:16. He says these words, "I saw under the sun the place of judgment." That wickedness was there. And the place of righteousness, that iniquity, was there. You see, the place of judgment, the place of righteousness, the courts ought to uphold what's right and good. And yet Solomon could say, as he looked under the sun at the world at large, the world without God, not under God, but under the sun, when he looked at the way life went about under the sun, oftentimes wickedness was in the place where righteousness should have been. And so I think it's clear that many in Shushan were perplexed, but particularly the Jews themselves in Shushan must have been perplexed. The next two Lord's days from now we'll look at Mordecai and how perplexed he was when he became aware of this decree. In closing, in an application, let us be reminded of the irreconcilable war that exists between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. That's what's going on here. Is it not? The Amalekite, the man that comes from this lineage and the seed of the king of the Amalekites, he now is placed in a position of authority and he's going to bring God's people down. He's going to act the liar. He's going to act as the accuser of the brethren, just like Satan himself. And as we see this, be reminded that our war is not against flesh and blood. Satan is behind this work. He's behind Haman's plotting. He's seeking to destroy the people of God. He sought to do it, did he not? When he put the Lord of glory on the cross. And yet in his efforts to win the day, he brought himself down. He brought himself to naught as he sought to take charge. Just as he had before creation, when he sought to usurp God's authority and became proud and boastful, and God cast him from heaven. So be reminded of that irreconcilable war, but also see that in providence God raises up the humble and he brings down the low. This proud man brings down the proud. In providence he raises up the humble, he brings down the proud. Here he's just raised up the proud. He will humble him. He will bring him down. Thirdly and lastly, let us realize that this political maneuvering, this pride and selfish ambition exists even in the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're looking at it here in a heathen kingdom. But Paul could say in Galatians 5:15 that the people there in Galatia were biting and devouring one another. He says, you're acting like animals towards one another in the church. James could say in James chapter 4, verse 1, why are there wars and tumults among you? Because there's lusts in your own heart. Because each is trying to get ahead of the other. That's why there's competition, because everybody's trying to win. And we live in a culture, we're exposed to a culture that everybody is trying to win. Everybody's trying to be the hero. But that's not the way the kingdom of heaven is to be. So let us be mindful that this political maneuvering goes on in the church as well as in the world. And let us seek to rid the church of such. Let us pray. Please rise for prayer.